Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource, and we are grateful to all of our listeners who help us keep the podcast going by donating to the show, which is something that everyone can do by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. A special thank you also goes out to the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their substantive support of the show. Welcome to part two of our episode on remote work. In part one, we've discussed everything that has to do with Forrester's paper and his critique of the futurists back in 1988. So if you want to learn more about what the actual paper is about, go back and listen to part one. Now we're going to talk about what are the contemporary implications of his work, how did it pan out after all these years, and specifically what are some of the things that we're experiencing now. And this was recorded while the pandemic was still going around, if there's anyone listening in the future who's left. And what's up basically with this work? What can we learn? What have we learned? And what are some of the things that are different now?
Well, I think for one, Forrester was pretty onto it in the sense that, yes, remote work has been around the last 10 years or so. There are people who work remotely, but it's remained a niche practice despite the technology aspect that he thought would be one of the limitations actually being pretty much sorted. We've got all of the sorts of technologies that he was concerned about in the home, and yet a lot of people are still going to the office. That's still the normal way of working, or it was until very recently, that people were still commuting in and out to these expensive buildings. Companies have found it worthwhile to invest in that office space to maintain it, and it's continued to be the dominant ritual of working life, the 9-to-5 schedule or more, and the daily commute. So I find it quite interesting that even though all that technological progress happened, the limitations that he predicted, or the kind of lack of widespreadness of remote work has panned out the way he predicted.
So actually, I found another article that William Atkinson wrote in the Personnel Journal in 1985. And in that article, he says several things to companies, like what would be a good remote worker, kind of based upon his study of the psychological problems of working from home. And he for instance says, like, it might not be for everyone, especially not for people that recently joined the company, because they don't know how it operates, and it's harder to get to know that when you're remote. Also, not everybody has the psychological makeup to work from home satisfactorily. And people that place a high priority on social relationships that the office has to offer also don't do well working from home. And this kind of made me think. And for instance, one thing he says is that remote workers must be as integrated in company life as on-site workers, but in terms of formal and informal events, and companies must facilitate the co-worker interaction. You know, a lot of these things were the idea that we're still in office, but now we're in a place and time there is an office, but it's locked. We cannot enter it. Many countries are now opening up again. But, there are also some companies that don't have an office to begin with. And other companies now, for instance, I think Twitter is thinking about just allowing everybody to work remote. What other companies? There are some other companies there that are... Facebook Salesforce is also thinking about it. And I'd love to have a broader conversation about, what can we learn from these other articles about, what can happen when companies massively think like, hey, this home working is kind of working out. People are kind of productive. Why do we actually need the office? It's a big expense to rent office space. And Ella, I particularly like your paper there, which I think was spot on because you already studied this and also developed the vocabulary to talk about some of the feelings that workers have when they're not part of the office. You mentioned like this idea of exile, feeling in exile, and how that is a lived experience of workers. When you think about the office and you relate it to how control and managerial control is exercised and the old idea of the panopticon. I was wondering if you can tell some more about it and what your thoughts are now when there is no office. Everybody is remote. Is it changing anything?
Yeah, this has been a strange time because this paper that I wrote about remote working came out just as everyone started to think about remote work and became remote workers, many for the first time, actually. And when I studied remote workers during my PhD, which was in Australia, I was talking to people who mainly worked for organizations where there was a head office, where there were co-located colleagues, and they were therefore the abnormal component of the organization by working from home. And talking to them, I could really sense this fear that they had that they were being left out, overlooked, forgotten, even sometimes feeling like they were banished. And that sentiment then led me to explore this idea of exile. And it's a very rich set of literature on exile. So reading through that literature actually helped me to understand some of these quite existentially painful feelings that were coming across in interviews with remote workers. And the idea there was also, well, first of all, to kind of give some voice to that lived experience, because it is a marginalized and also marginal category in the world of work, and yet no longer. So everyone is now on the margins, and I think that unsettles the paradigm a little bit, and I'm really curious to know whether people still experience this feeling of being left out. Because on the other hand, like Dimitris was saying, there's also such an effort being made to keep everyone connected now that everyone is out of the office. So in some companies, in some groups, in some departments, the amount of meetings, as we discussed in part one, that people are having is pretty insane. And that was not the experience of these remote workers. They were often left out of those kind of meetings that were face-to-face because it's a hassle to dial in a remote worker. But now that the managers too are working from home, there's more of this sort of impetus to, oh, let's get everyone involved. So to me, it's a question mark. I don't know if people still experience this idea of exile in this context. Does anyone here relate to that?
Yeah, it kind of makes me think about, like, for instance, I think Natalia wrote about it, kind of these power asymmetries, often in distributed settings when, most of the people in a meeting are in the office. And some join remote, there's a symmetry in who participates in the meeting and who has a voice, with remote workers often being left out or hard to get into the conversation. Technology partly resolved that, and now we're all remote. So does that fix those things? To share some personal experience, I just changed jobs before we went into a lockdown, and besides email, we don't have any technologies in place that might be very different for you guys or in other companies. But I think as academics, we mostly work on our own projects with our collaborators, but not so much with colleagues in our department. There might be like an over response to be hyper connected now, but there might also be an under response or not knowing if the culture wasn't there in the first place, how to establish it. I think that those are some challenges HR people are thinking about at the moment.
For sure. And this is an interesting connection to HR as a profession, because at least when I used to teach HR, I remember I was coming from a more technology angle when I was teaching, and I remember speaking to them about Slack. This was a master's cohort of HR practitioners that were already in the workforce. I remember talking to them about the enterprise social media platform, Slack, which is like a Facebook that people use in the workplace. And when I told them about it, they were so shocked about this platform. They were like, what if people are inappropriate? How can we lock it down, basically? How do we control it and secure it and make sure no one shares anything they shouldn't? And I was so surprised because to me, the HR function has a role to play in facilitating the social connection between people, and technology is one tool for that. So that reaction was quite instructive to me, that hasn't necessarily been at the core of that function in recent times, and yet now it becomes such an important role, and technology needs to be used in the current context to facilitate that role, and it's not necessarily where the competencies lie or the experiences. And it's hard to set this stuff up at this point. It is, as you say, much easier if it's been running for a while, for sure.
And it might be that tech companies are you know, ahead of the game. They're at this moment. I'm thinking of, for instance, my sister who works at a tech company in Sweden. And on Fridays, they have a social. And on Thursdays, they come and bring a drink to everyone. They deliver it at their home. So when they have the social, wow, they all have a drink bought by the company. And so when you think about, you know, the idea of exile, that's really not there. You really feel like they think about you with these small gestures. And it's really meaningful when you're working from home, I think.
Those kind of things can be super powerful. And I remember some anecdotes from my research where people's birthdays had been commemorated with physical gifts being sent to the home. And that crossing of the sort of digital physical divide can be immensely powerful. And I haven't looked into exactly why that might be, but I think we can relate as well. For example, people also being sent company t-shirts and things when others in the office would receive them. But that requires this extra level of conscientiousness and concern and effort. And again, previously, as you mentioned with the power asymmetry, that was such a burden that someone had to think of people who weren't physically in front of them, and they would often be overlooked because they're not sitting there with everyone else. And yet now the playing field is more even. So I think it's less likely that people would get left out in a circumstance like that where everyone's receiving something or getting a gift. And yet I think there are new forms of in-group, out-group that can form. And that's particularly because things like collaboration or even giving work, like distributing work tasks and assignments, that's still done in a lot of companies via line of sight. And that's where the current situation can really reinforce the path of least resistance, the habits that people are used to. Oh, that's who I ask when I need something, or that's who I give this sort of nice assignment to. And therefore, there are people who will kind of drift away from those newly formed centers that are not geographic in the physical sense, but that form from a social perspective.
Yeah, it's really forces one to potentially consider what is the relationship between organized work and the social experience in the organization, because at what point did we ever decide that a workplace also has to be a social experience, right? And I can't pinpoint that. We began with a very individualized work in the factories where, you know, people would be working in their workstations, and then that sort of transitioned into HR to an extent. And then suddenly the workplace is something that you have to have friends, you have coffees together, you have these out of work events. And that's, I mean, I understand that with the whole HR movement that was meant to foster motivation and company loyalty and all that sort of overt production boosting, covert production boosting, you know, methodology. But, you know, now that we're all home, well, not all of us, clearly, lots of people are not working from home. Lots of people who work in low-paid jobs are not working from home. Lots of people who work in care and healthcare and law enforcement and, you know, military, and they're not working from home either. But the middle-class, white-collar workers, such as, you know, ourselves and various professional services people who are working from home, you know, what's the role of this social aspect, and whether, you know, why are we taking for granted that that's something that should come with employment at all? The whole, Facebook, right? Facebook are the guys who, as well as Twitter. So Twitter said they're gonna try to leave as much remote workforce as possible, and Facebook said that they're gonna pay you based on where you are, which are interesting approaches that I think even 10 years ago, when everyone was crazy about Google campuses and all the cakes and ping pong and massage chairs at work, wouldn't even think that would be a good idea. Now that's just something that's happening. You know, you can work from home because your productivity is not impacted by the office in the case of Twitter. And in the case of Facebook, you can work wherever, but you're also going to be paid based not on the work you do, but based on where you are located physically. Interesting.
Very controversial, that decision.
So can you tell a bit more about that? Like, do they pay you more when you work from home or
no? Less? If you work for Facebook and you're meant to be in where are they based? Somewhere in California. But if you decide to move to Ralph in Albuquerque, presumably lower cost of living, you're going to get salary proportionately reduced towards that cost of living.
But you need an office at home and a desk and an internet connection, and you use more electricity.
You just get a laptop and a headset and off you go, presumably. Okay. I don't know what people in Facebook do.
Well, this is a kind of flip side to the conversation, which is what have offices become, which you're getting at with these, you know, ping pong, if anyone's visited any of these tech offices, it's quite amazing. And they enjoy taking you on tours through them so you can see the ping pong tables and the bean bags and the nap rooms and, you know, the cafeterias and stuff. But there's also this sort of stigma around anyone who's actually using those things, or at least in my experience of it. The actual space where people work is still quite small and not necessarily that luxurious, the actual workstations. So there's this sort of frill of sociality around it, but the actual labor that's being done is still has a pretty conventional setup. And then in another context where I was doing research in a bank, it was one of these setups which is overloaded with workers. So a flexible office where everyone's supposed to come in and find a spot to sit. And a lot of people finding themselves working on beanbags all day. And my point here is that the office has not actually become that conducive for work, which I've found a really strange transition, that it's supposed to be this other place where you can go and concentrate. And that's kind of the Forrester argument, that it's important to have this office space. But so many offices today have been turned into what you would associate with the home, a place to relax, to chill out, to talk. And it's actually become not very conducive to the focused work that's supposed to go on there. And so a lot of people then have been shifting the equation and going in to meet people and going home to work in the evenings even, or in other times. I suspect that this shift away from, well, maybe we don't need the office, also has something to do with what the office is having been eroded in recent years into something that doesn't actually offer a very good alternative to home, especially in the case of open plan offices, for example.
Yeah, there's something about what the office is, and then there's something else about what the office does. And I want to talk about what the office does a bit later on. But what the thing about the open plan office is just a quick anecdote from my doctoral work that I did with an architectural firm. People there, so the architects, were fully aware of a variety of studies that showed that open plan offices are not conducive to work, and in fact might be counterproductive when it comes to efficiency, especially with kind of the more professional services industries. And they were still designing them, but they weren't designing them because their clients wanted offices that would be the best place to do work in. They were designing them because open plan offices are cheaper to heat, for example. And then we know of works that emphasize that open plan offices are also great because you can see everyone and you can see whether they're working or not, or whether they're on social media or not, if that's something that's not permitted in the company. It's basically a better area of observing what people do, which is what some of these apps and technologies also are trying to do now with remote work.
I kept thinking about this and all that we learn about the distinction of formal and informal organization and how we think about effectiveness in organizations, especially because we learn a lot from the literature about the importance of face-to-face interactions and tacit knowledge. And informal organizations is important to secure the workers' rights too. So we're thinking in terms of isolation and of the remote work, how can we think about this? How is an informal organization built in terms of remote work? And that's something that there's only literature about organizations since the Barnard and so on, I think. But on the other hand, tacit knowledge is something that that was theorizing, stressing the importance of body movement and the charismatic figures and so on. And so all that things depends on will be in the shop floor or in the office interacting with everybody. So how can we think about this in a remote situation?
You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, the point you raised, Leonardo and Demetrius, it makes us think of two things. And the epidemic makes us reflect on if they were the right direction to go, where you see, you know, what offices have become. And now the problem, everybody hot desking, having airco around, making a huge health and safety risk now to return to work. There are even offices where you cannot open the window yourself. All ventilation is happening through airco. So if one is infected with COVID, everybody gets it. And you know, how do you return to work in such a building? That's like what the outbreak. It's a huge crisis that these companies and employers are in to provide safe workspaces for their employees. And to your point, Leonardo, I saw this Financial Times article by Lucy Calloway, who I think she worked for the Financial Times, if I remember it correctly. And after about 35 years in 2017, she left. And she talks about what going to the office meant for her. And I was really, it really touched me what she said in that article. I can share some of the quotes what she says. She says, "The office not only provided me with a place of work, but it gave me a routine, structure, amusement, purpose, many friends, and a refuge in times of trouble. It was where I want to pass my days. The office was my rock." And she says, like, the most important thing of an office is that it gives work its meaning. Most of what passes for work in offices is pretty meaningless. And the best way to kid yourself it actually matters is to do it alongside other people intent doing the same. So even in interesting jobs like journalism, she mentions there, meaning comes largely from physical proximity to your colleagues. And then at the end, she says, I found it very beautiful. "The office helps us keep sane. It imposes routine, forces us to establish habits, and it creates a barrier between work and home, allowing to escape the chaos of our hearts." And I think she really found the language to say something that we all feel now, in what it, you know, we don't just work to make money, we also work to interact with other adults, to escape, to leave the home for the home, and to when you're working in teams on a project, you it's a sense of your identity. And you know, I don't know how it is for you guys, but in my social circle, I have some friends that really struggle now in the lockdown, having to work remote. And you know, working remote is so far away from their natural way of living. For instance, think about teachers. You know, it lends a certain personality to be a teacher, to be 8 hours a day with kids, having 30 kids in the classroom, you're an extremely social person to do that. And now you're just at home all the time. You know, it's so a mismatch. Think about therapists, counselors, coaches, trainers, that now all have to use Zoom or Skype to talk with their clients or with people that make use of their services. You know, and they say it's not the same. Like the connection is not there. And I think, you know, these stories make us think about, you know, what is it in work and what is it that a workplace gives us that we're missing out now? And what is it, for instance, that these people in Ella's study that talk about exile, that they experience as missing when you cannot go somewhere?
Yeah, I think that these are really important points and ones that will resonate with a lot of people, especially right now. And I think there's a couple of things to unpack, because the current situation with COVID-19 is so extreme. And I think at the moment, a lot of people are equating what they're experiencing now as remote work, whereas it's, and others have said this, remote work during a pandemic. And this idea of routine, having another place to go, and is so important, and it's completely denied us now. And it's not only the office that's been taken away, it's the local cafe where you might also take your laptop and work. It's in some instances the park or the cinema, these other social areas where you can be with others or by yourself, but still in a third place, in another place, and all we have left is the home. And I think it's important to note that that's not actually the main experience that most remote workers have. They do develop these routines. They have favorite cafes, they have hotel lobbies, they have co-working spaces where they perhaps go once or twice a week. They've established these routines to overcome some of these limitations of remote work around being stuck in the four walls or not getting out of the house or needing interaction. And in fact, sometimes people say, you know, when they work remotely, that they get to be much more purposeful about who they're choosing to interact with and what places they're choosing to spend time in, rather than a hermetically sealed office building where you can't open the windows. You know, they can go to a friend's house or something to work, or sit with a colleague somewhere where they find the environment inspiring, or like digital nomads go to Bali. So it's not a feature of remote work to have to always be at home. And in fact, you know, how it should be is that you can take a walk when you want and imagine and think in the ways that you want. Or like I like to do, lie on the floor to think through a paper, which would be looked at pretty strangely in our open plan office. So there are all of these advantages that currently we don't have. And I think that that's important to keep in mind without denying any of the hardship that people are experiencing right now. And so that was one. What was my other point? And in terms of when we do go back to the office, because I'm assuming that will happen in most instances, I hope that we can take away some of the things we have learned about the way we're working now, that sometimes it's better. I'm teaching online at the moment. And for example, student consultations with teams via Zoom are so efficient. They don't need to travel all the way into the university to meet with me for 10 minutes, which just seems like a waste of their time. They're so much more engaged for that amount of time because they're not coordinating their physical selves. They could just talk to me. And there are these advantages, but we've treated the office as such a default. That's always the expectation. Co-location, which is so expensive, is the inevitable starting point. Whereas now we're starting to see an alternative, and it's not always perfect, but maybe we can start to take a bit more of a reflective approach to choosing when we come together and make the most of it when we do.
But also not to forget that offices as physical social spaces serve other functions than just providing a workplace for people. They highlight lines of hierarchy. They highlight who is in charge, who and who isn't. They highlight who are the clients and who are not clients. The materiality of work, you know, sometimes is a big part of why the work is done in a certain way, especially if we're not looking at offices as a room full of computers and a couple of printers and a coffee machine, but, you know, like, Ralph is not here today with us, but like a engine room on a nuclear submarine, you know, that's a pretty unique office, or anything else where the actual nature of work is inseparable from the, you know, place where the work is done. And that raises a host of whole other questions, also to do with what an organization becomes when it's devout of its essential materiality, but also what happens to some of these informal organizational features that Leonardo brought up, like how do you emerge as an informal leader, for example. You know, we all studied formal and informal organizations as in bachelors. It's like one of the first thing you study in a management course. You know, how do you get that going or maintain when you can't meet, you know, in the workplace in some cases without managerial authorization, right?
Well, there I think technology though is the answer. For example, in this bank that I've been mentioning, some interviewees were saying there's this whole parallel organization happening on their enterprise social network that only those who are involved know about, and there's grassroots leadership happening in that space, and we're listening to this guy, but others don't recognize his leadership or even know that it's happening because they're not in that space and they see it as inferior to the real physical office. And I think we see that kind of leadership happening in spaces like Twitter as well, where you have people who are gaining a voice and a followership. So why can't that happen in these organizations?
Well, I mean, it can, obviously. The question is then, you know, what happens when this is a new thing? So how do you find something out when you can't just go and see? You know, how do you interact with situations that are you're not direct privy to? You know, such as with our podcast, right? We've never had an office, nor will we. But we have a whole bunch of listeners that we're not aware of that are part of, you know, if we draw a really broad line around our organization that are part of it, you know, they have no access to what we do by and large. There is no participation in the organization. And similar, if you have a core management team, for example, that usually work with a bunch of subcontractors or part-time workers, that's all gone. No one can see anyone. No one necessarily has access to anyone else. And then you throw in the technological challenges of perhaps internet connections or power of computers and so on and so forth. It's not gone in a sense that we're all now living in 1984, where the managerial big brother is telling us when to talk and who to talk to. But it's, you know, informal organization is not on the side of the advantage here, I think.
Well, to me, I kind of have a counter perspective to this, but it's from speaking to people who have been doing this for a long time and they've figured out their ways. And of course, it's never perfect, but there are all sorts of examples of people constructing their own backstages in remote work. For example, I interviewed nurses who work from home, and this is in Australia. They help patients over the phone. And one of the ways because they're completely isolated. They're on their own. They don't know what it means to be a tele-nurse. That's a whole new thing for them. They used to work in hospitals. Some of them have problems with their backs and things, so that's why they work from home now. And they're like, what is this new way of working? But they use pretty simple technologies to start to, for example, listen in on each other's calls and then discuss them afterwards, like debriefing. So that's a kind of tacit knowledge transferal example. And then they also have an instant messaging system where they're messaging each other even while they're on calls to get advice and help as they're going. So even in front of the client, they can have this backstage space going. And it's tricky at first. They find it a bit difficult. But over time, these are just some examples of how they then can replicate what they had in the hospital. And one nurse said that they have in that chat space where they just start chatting with whoever's on at that time, so whoever shares a shift with them, they say it's just like having a cup of tea and a smoke in the tea room, which is probably referring to an earlier time in hospitals, but they still are able to replicate what they experienced in co-located work in this digital setting, but it takes time. And then they are also enabled by the less physical nature of that work because of disabilities and things, but also it gives them some distance from patients who can sometimes be very aggressive. So they quite like that aspect of it as well. It's just one example, but I think that it doesn't always have to be complex technologies that can start to fulfill purposes and functions that we're used to attributing to physical proximity, water coolers, coffee machines. We actually have a bot right now in our Slack channel that every Monday partners you with someone from the group to have coffee with, and then you have to get in touch with them. But we have a bot who's facilitating the informal organization in our team.
That sounds terrible. maybe for
me. I find it actually very interesting.
It is interesting, but...
Yeah. And it kind of made me think about, you know, not every organization is in the same stage of development. So you have, you know, you have companies that were fully on site and now go fully remote. You have organizations where part already work remote and they found these supporting structures outside the workplace institutions that are in the office. And then you have a companies that were already fully remote and that had these all these social activities and, you know, that make work meaningful and that where you do have that feeling of connectedness and meaningfulness, even though there wasn't an office. So there are very different starting points and there are different changes now. I'm just thinking about some of the work that my colleagues have been doing on the worker side of freelancers that work on these online labor platforms. And one of the findings that my colleague Leren Ruta found was about, you know, how do you cope with time and flexibility? And even when you have full flexibility and control over your time, people really find it hard to make full use of it. And I think that again makes refers to this idea of self-management that is so important. And kind of what you say here, allies, you know, you can find some technology hacks such as bots to help you there, and so you don't have to do it all yourself. So that you can even automate, it's actually an interesting idea.
So not to mention the companies that are threat by remote work. For instance, airline companies are passing through hard times. Hotels are not doing well by this time. So we have some kind of, well, let me be a little philosophical here, but it's interesting how the economy depends on people going to places, going to hear from there, and how this is a harm to the business, their business model. They will have to change because remote work, I think, especially here in Brazil, I think came to stay. It will be very difficult to return how things were before the pandemic here.
I mean, the remote work term, it still has work in it, just that's remote. You know, it's not a different kind of a thing. It's just done same thing done differently. And I kept thinking about this book that Benedict Anderson, I think, wrote in the early 2000s on the imagined communities and how large of a role just agreeing to reify some abstract concept such as an organization by means of, you know, uniforms, offices, rituals, colors, flags, you know, whatever, logos, plays in actually enacting these things that make up an economy and livelihood and translate into being able to go to a shop and buy some food or fuel and drive someplace. And how perhaps with the, you know, the situation that we're in and the increase in remoteness of the work, how some of these imaginations are really taking a hard left, especially with, you know, the case of Twitter and Facebook that we discussed earlier, but also what Leonardo just said, like the businesses that only function because someone has to go there. Yeah, hotels, airlines, but also a lot of the cultural and creative industries like cinemas, theaters, museums to a lesser extent. I currently work on a European project on creative and cultural industries. People are freaking out. And I had this chat with a person who runs a large creative sort of an association in Europe. And she was asking how come malls, shopping centers open, but cinemas cannot. And, you know, one is tempted to think of that in terms of, well, you know, lobbying power and contribution to the GDP and so on and so forth. But, you know, you can also think of it in terms of that in a theater, people have to sit next to each other for a whole bunch of time and then get infected. Whereas in a museum, you can just walk around. Point being that, yeah, on the one hand, you have things that have to do with how organizations are and how we think of them, and what that includes technology, what we think that can do. But then there's the pandemic that I think someone said earlier, nothing has done more to transition so much of our work remotely, no technology, no innovation, no management consultants, as a a virus has. So there's external factors that just come in play and you can't do anything about this.
And in a sense, it's kind of putting under the microscope what impact it has on a society. Like, who now makes a good living and who lost their job due to the pandemic? What work can happen remote and which people are still at risk? When you think, for instance, at the gig economy workers, like Uber drivers and Deliveroo, that don't have any healthcare insurance but still have to work to make a living for very little money. And then also thinking about how the shift to home working impacted family life. Thinking about the division of home labor, homework. And for instance, the finding that most of the papers submitted to academic journals at the moment are by men. So the men benefit from the pandemic. And the mothers, they're taking care of the kids that can't go to school anymore. I'm also thinking about our colleague Tom, who has three kids at home and having to juggle, having to teach, doing all these other things. And now, you know, there are no separations anymore. And what you see now, what it puts under the microscope, in many families, we go back to our defaults. And that's the mom taking on the care responsibilities. And, it's thinking about this leveling. The office does play a role there. As a mom, maybe also, you know, it takes a change of setting to enable to change in role, I can imagine.
So what have we learned from this piece from 32 years ago? If anything, obviously.
Well, my kind of takeaway was it takes work to make remote work work. I kind of stole it from you.
That's very catchy.
At least that's how I interpret it. It takes effort. It doesn't go by itself. And you have to be very mindful. And I think there are a lot of learnings now in this pandemic. And, the key point is to predict if we need an office, if we can make remote organizations succeed. You need to look at empirics and really need to include everyone in the study, and not just the ones that do have a big house and an office.
Yeah. I thought that some of the things that were highlighted in the paper, but also that are really becoming more visible now, have to do with kind of cutting through some of the veil that has enveloped organizations over the past 100 years or so. You know, the things that I highlighted, the brought up, like what's the role of the social aspect? You know, what do we think of when we think about work, and how much of that has to do with actual work and how much of that has to do with other things that might not necessarily be important. They might be, they might not. You know, what does the office do? And not all of it good, of course, as Greta highlighted, thing with exacerbating certain societal divisions, that some of the progress is being lost there. But also I think some of it is for the good of, you know, seeing what a lot of the whole hype with Google's hyper-entertaining offices and such has been about, and what's the real deal there.
Yeah, I think that the text and all this situation that we are living now shows that technology is it's not an end in itself, it's a means to achieve greater things, and we have to have better institutions to like to direct this kind of movement, and see what we are doing with this kind of technology in organizations specifically, because I think we are talking in a kind of some kind of technology optimist, like the author was saying, and we are talking some how many jobs will be replaced, how many by robots and so on, and now we are seeing the importance of the social aspect and the working together, and how can we live together in this kind of in organizations and remote work.
Great reflections. For me, it's really highlighted the role of place in work, but also in life, and how these places actually start to help us make sense of what work and life and home are. And we've had these established routines, for example, of leaving the home and going to work, which are, like I've said in part one, relatively new. Working from home was once upon a time the norm. But since we have constructed the office as the centralized location of work, it's become such a big part of how we even understand ourselves, our work, our social life. And now this is needing some reconsideration. And I think it's a healthy time to reconsider it along a number of aspects. For example, I think we've become too reliant on the workplace as a source of identity and social cohesion, as others have been saying. You know, why is it that we're spending so much time in these places? Why have they become this kind of clubhouse phenomenon? Why are we expected to, and why do we want to socialize so much with colleagues? Well, it's the dominant institution that we have access to today. The work has replaced a lot of other community institutions that have played a role in the past, whether that's religion for some, or sport for others, or perhaps even a community center or volunteering work. We've put so much of our time and selves into our work that these other things have fallen away in a lot of contexts. And this is perhaps an opportunity to look at, well, what happens if we're not so drawn to the office? What opportunities are there closer to home? Like Greta was saying, talking to neighbors, actually getting to know the people around us a little bit more. And I think that what remote work can offer is that more community-mindedness outside of the work context. But then on the other hand, and my final point would be, we've been talking in these binaries, the office or the home. And my latest thinking on this is that we need to reimagine what the office is, that the office is not a building because it doesn't do anything by itself. It's us with our work, with our technologies and with each other that we actually construct something meaningful. And therefore, why can't that occur in a distributed way with a whole range of different human and non-human actors in a more performative sense? So I think that we can actually start to reimagine what the office is and make it a broader phenomenon than what we've been working with so far.
Definitely something to think of for the future. Well, thank you, Ella, for coming back. It's been a pleasure.
So good to see you all again, and we do see each other this time as well.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. You may not know this, but we really love receiving feedback from our listeners. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some of the best people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Riener, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Karamustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Peaks Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Lechton Virta, and Gabriel Van Bonen. And I apologize if I mispronounced your name. You are still the best and we love you so much. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website where a donations button will greet you. You can't miss it. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time for the next episode here on Talking About Organizations.